thenewspress.com.
Good afternoon, and welcome to another edition of AHA Presents About Education. I'm Neil Kreisel, and I'm your host every week right here on AM 1290, repeated at 10 on Saturdays at 4. We're brought to you by Deckers, makers of Uggs and Tevas, Pierre LaFon, Wendy Foster, offering fine clothes, good food, and vintage wines, Montecito Bank and Trust, proudly serving our communities and their financial needs for over 40 years, Habitat for Humanity, building strength, stability, and self-reliance through shelter, and CSU Channel Islands. No matter which of their academic programs you choose, you will be at the center of your educational experience. And we're here today with Dr. Manu Eskadari, who is the director of the Middle East Studies Program and professor in the Department of Political Science and Economics at Santa Barbara City College. And you have so many other titles. If I just kept listing them, we wouldn't have any time to talk. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So, Middle East studies seems to be particularly important today.
Yes. That's why we created the program at City College about 10, 11 years ago, with the idea of showing the students at City College and in the town and in the larger community a different side to what's in the headlines, you know, wars, destruction, terrorism. There is another side to a large swath of the population of this globe. And that was the idea, to inform people about the cultural aspects of the Middle East, the historical aspects, the importance of the Middle East. And we've had the program for about 11 years on and off with great success.
And right now, there's, as there always is, a great deal of talk about Middle East issues, not just the Israeli-Palestinian issue, but the Muslim ban, which in the paper today, I was shocked. There was a poll. Now, I understand that polling is about how you ask the question in many ways.
Right.
But in this particular poll, 60% of Americans approved of the travel ban, even though there appears to be no evidence that it will save any lives. How destructive is that to pick five countries out, pick a religion out, and create a travel ban?
Well, none of the countries that were picked out for the ban have had any people from those countries engaging in any terrorist acts here. It's a very unfortunate matter and much more complex to be able to go into in a conversation here. But of course, every country has the right to determine who comes in, who gets visas. It could have been done if there were any concerns about any travelers from any of the countries of the Middle East and North Africa or from the larger Islamic region, or for that matter, from any country in the world. They could have been doing it through the State Department, through restrictions on visas, as they have been doing in the past, without having these spectacular pronouncements and cameras and signing of executive orders, which, had the opposite effect. Now, it so happens that the ban is partially agreed to by the Supreme Court. And then it has these comical aspects to it that if you have a bona fide relationship with anyone here, then you're allowed from those countries. And immediate family, for instance, is allowed, but grandparents are not. Now, explain this to anyone in the world that your grandparents are not your immediate family, other than the notion of a nuclear family, which is this thing in America where family is your parents and your siblings. Explain this to anyone in the world, that grandparents are not part of your family, and it becomes comical. So there are too many aspects to this to really be able to unpack. If I had been asked, and I have not, I would have said this can be done, whatever the concerns are. It could have been done through the channels that are off camera and off, you know, the public display. And in fact, America has been doing this. Its visa restrictions are some of the most restricted in the world, and its immigration procedures are some of the strictest in the world. And applications for refugees are some of the longest applications in the world. It's already been done. So this was not necessary. But of course, as a political scientist, I tell you that this was red meat for the base, and the base, of course, lapped it up.
Well, of course, my grandchildren don't call me back, so I think that they must be Republicans.
They must have bought into the ban.
Going through this sort of myths about the reality of the world, what are some of the myths about Muslims that Americans just don't understand?
The myths about, to talk about an entire population, 1.234 billion people with one term, Muslim, is as difficult as saying Christians or as saying Jews or as saying Zoroastrians or as saying Buddhists. It's a meaningless generalization. What we're focusing on is we're assuming that all Muslims or all Christians follow the same edicts because of the label Christian or Muslim or Jew or whichever religious affiliation that you're naming here, and that therefore all of them would be doing the same thing, acting in the same way, thinking in the same way. So that's the great myth, that there is something called a Muslim, or that there is something called Muslims that can be, you know, summarized in five or six or seven different statements.
But what's so interesting is that when Obama spoke of terrorism, he was very careful to talk about a certain portion of, and a minority portion of Muslims that he said was a distorted view of the religion. And Trump continued during the campaign and now to say that was a problem, you should paint them all. Well, so you know this is not just we're not talking just philosophy here. There's a real politic issue here.
It is politics, and as with the previous question, every politician has to look to their base. There are always different audiences that politicians address, and so this is again one of those issues that has to do with a domestic audience that one relies on. There is no question that amongst the violent groupings in the world, there are those who are labeling themselves as Muslims and are committing violent acts. So there is no question about this. This should not be a matter of discussion.
Against Muslims, by the way.
Against Muslims and against, mainly against Muslims, it turns out, but also against the rest of the world, reaching all the way to the West and to the heart of America. This is also true of Buddhists in Burma. Aung San Suu Kyi, who is now, who was at one point the representative of all the aspirations of the Burmese, is now denying that there is a genocide against the Muslim population of Burma. And the genocide has been occurring through the efforts of Buddhist monks. So are we saying all Buddhists are terrorists or Buddhists are genocidal? I mean, it's one of those things. I don't mean to defend anyone. And in fact, I am not. I want to make sure, because I don't know who your audience is here. What I'm asking for is a bit more critical distance from generalizations.
And what happened in the Arab Spring? Was that doomed to failure? Did it help in any way? Whatever help means.
Some of my friends remind me that I did say when the Arab Spring was happening that, a swallow does not a spring make. People were very eager to pronounce, oh, look, you know, democracy has kind of, you know, sprung, has broken out everywhere. And we're now seeing this new era across the Middle East and North Africa. It takes longer for democracy to take root than just, you know, a sprouting of a few shoots here, there, yonder. And unfortunately, the phenomenon was sidetracked very, very fast, because there is a desire amongst certain elites in the Middle East that this not happen. Obviously, they resisted it tooth and nail.
What's really, for me, a reason to take your courses is the expression for baseball, you need a scorecard to watch this game. You look at the Turks, you look at the Iranians, you look at the Goodness, Egyptians. Yeah. You don't know who's playing for what side.
Yeah.
It's just looking at that tells you there's a diversity.
The first assumption has to be that everybody is playing for themselves. Mm-hmm. That's the first assumption in the Middle East.
And playing for themselves nationalistically, interestingly, not necessarily religiously.
Yes, nationalistically. That must be the first rule of the game. It's all about self-interest. Now, having said that, self-interest is defined in complex ways. Sometimes it includes even siding up to your harshest enemies for political purposes. Saudi Arabia and ISIS, for instance, or Saudi Arabia and other groups that are labeled terrorist groups. It makes for very weird bedfellows. But the rule number one in politics is it's all about self-interest.
You're listening to AHA Presents on AM 1290 KZSB. And when we come back, Dr. Eskandari will give us the solution to the Israeli-Palestinian crisis.
Here's a question. Do you enjoy experiencing the best of Santa Barbara? Tasty restaurants, scenic hiking, local banking experts. That's right, local banking experts. Montecito Bank and Trust was voted best bank again by the Santa Barbara Independent, Santa Barbara News Press, and Santa Ynez Valley News Readers. Plus, they have over 40 years of experience, 10 branches from Solvang to Westlake, a convenient on-the-go mobile banking app, and a savvy team of local decision makers. Visit Montecito.bank today. Montecito Bank and Trust, member FDIC.
For more than 20 years now, the unique landscape and people of the Santa Barbara community have helped grow Deckers brands into the lifestyle footwear leaders they are today. Newly opened at their headquarters in Goleta, the Deckers brand showcase allows you to explore and shop the UGG, Teva, Sanuk, Hoka, and Ahnu brands while you're likely to discover something new or potentially receive an in-store special offer. At 250 Coromar Drive in Goleta, the showcase is open to the public 10 a.m. to 7 Monday through Saturday and 11 to 5 on Sunday.
In 1962, Pierre Lafond founded the first post-prohibition commercial winery in Santa Barbara County. In 1972, he planted his first vineyard in the San Ynez Valley west of Buellton and later hired legendary winemaker Bruce McGuire to continue to build on the stellar reputation that Santa Barbara Winery has achieved for more than 50 years. Today, you're invited to experience the award-winning wines at Santa Barbara Winery at the corner of Yananali and Anacapa and the Lafond Winery at 6855 Santa Rosa Road in Buellton.
Habitat for Humanity of Southern Santa Barbara County is building strength, stability, and self-reliance through shelter. Habitat has completed construction on 19 new homes for affordable homeownership. We'll build 3 new affordable homes this spring and has repaired over 35 homes through the A Brush with Kindness program. To learn more about how you can support Habitat by volunteering, donating, or shopping at the Habitat Restore, visit sbhabitat.org or call 692-2226.
Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA, using innovative social-emotional learning and character building to help teens. I'm Neil Kreisel, and we're here with Dr. Manu Eskandari, who is the director of the Middle East Studies Program at Santa Barbara City College. And I was joking before that he was going to share with us the solution for the Palestinian-Israeli crisis, but what is your view on that 75-year-old problem? You don't have any time to think about this. This is not a big deal. Just answer.
Let's be very clear at this point. It is an intractable problem. Everybody recognizes that, except for some people in the administration, and perhaps they recognize it too. But for political purposes, statements were made that it could be resolved, and perhaps a deal could be struck. It has become an intractable problem. And there is a lack of willingness on both sides to engage in conversation, to select people who have absolutely no experience and background in conflict resolution to be the ambassadors could only be a solution temporary of goodwill, but certainly will not solve the problem. That said, also the Israeli-Palestinian problem now in the Middle East is not the main problem anymore. It has become basically a domestic and regional problem for Israel between the Israelis and the Palestinians. It is not the Middle East problem anymore. There are many, many larger problems that are playing themselves out. And I don't know if it's to the detriment of the Israelis and the Palestinians or to their benefit that it is now a regional problem, but experts on the Middle East do not consider it to be the main problem anymore. There are far greater problems that have to be looked at that are much more dangerous. That's just a low simmering fire that keeps going.
And why, I'm not trying to be funny here, why aren't Iran and Israel good friends? I mean, you think about it. Iraq was Israel's arch enemy, and they seem to have sort of similar interests. It almost looks like they should be aligned.
I know. It's very strange that you would ask this question. I've had conversations even the last few weeks with friends about this very question. It makes, to me, and it's not that it makes no sense that I cannot explain it. Obviously, as a political scientist, I can explain the moves that Iran is taking with regard to its geopolitical and strategic position in the Middle East. That's not the issue. My issue is this. What is the connection and what is the fascination between these Iranian elites and supporting the Palestinian cause? I mean, yes, I can understand that, you know, solidarity for revolutionary movements, et cetera, et cetera. But the Palestinian movement isn't a revolutionary movement anymore. So there is no natural connection between Iran and the Palestinian cause. There is no historical connection. There is a connection between Arafat and Khomeini on the revolution. The Palestinians did materially help Khomeini to come to power, no question. And so perhaps that connection still exists in a kind of gratitude on the part of certain elites, the Revolutionary Guards, etc., continues. There is also a connection, of course, between the Iranians and Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, Shia to Shia. And that goes back prior to the revolution, almost a decade prior to the revolution, with the arrival of Iranian clerics and forming a very strong bloc of Shias who have always been, you know, downtrodden in Lebanon. There is that. But it is a very weird conundrum that Iran has painted itself in this corner, that Israel is the enemy of Iran, and that Iran is sponsoring the most violent of the groups that are actually creating more havoc on the Palestinians themselves, Hamas, for instance, which is also a blight on the Palestinians more than it is a danger to Israel or anybody else. So it's been a main question on my mind. And yes, there are some answers, but none of them have been satisfactory enough for me to say, oh, this is why the Iranians are in that corner.
It's interesting because from a geopolitical standpoint, if they could make a deal, they would be a real powerhouse.
Absolutely.
It's their interest, and a lot of their politics is similar. So you'd think that they're natural bedfellows.
Obviously, as before the show, we talked about this, there is a long-standing connection between the Jewish community in exile and Persia and Iran. That connection continued through the reign of the Shah. It was severed. The connection between Iran and Israel was severed after the revolution. So obviously, some of the keys to the answer as to why this enmity now exists have to go back to the revolution. And that's a very unfortunate thing. But then Iran has become a pariah worldwide, and therefore all of its energies and its potential cannot be used. And there is this domestic dimension in Iran, obviously, between the ruling elites, which are split, and the people who have very different aspirations and different skills. Anytime you look at, top scientists in the world, you'll find Iranian names. You look at doctors, you look at physicists, you look at people who are part of the Mars mission in America, you find Iranians, founders of industries, you find Iranians. There is a disconnect between the aspirations and the skills of the people of Iran and the elites that are running the place.
And Persia has always been an entrepreneurial country and a scientifically astute country. And you have probably one of the lowest age demographics of any country.
Yeah.
what is it going to take for the old timers to move along? And obviously, the Arab Spring was sort of you know, a nice try, but when you have such a
Arab Spring, we need to expand this. The movement towards democracy. There was a hope that this would just happen. It obviously didn't. What would it take for Iran? There is an older generation of revolutionaries. That generation has to pass on. This new generation with President Rouhani, for instance, they realize this very, very keenly, that there are limits to how far you can push this because there are groups that will take you out. So there are limits to how much you can talk about let's move towards reform, because reform means one thing to one group and it means another to another. Reform could mean no more Islamic Republic, and that's where you get the Revolutionary Guards and the more radical groups to be completely against you. So it's a very slow movement, gradual movement away from radical talk. As this is happening, Iran is opening also, and the world is coming back into Iran. They just struck a major deal with a French oil company, billions of dollars. With the nuclear agreement, various countries are again dealing with Iran. And so to bring back Iran into the fold in this way and slowly, gently pushing aside the more aggressive elements of the government is a possibility if this trend continues. But it's a marathon run. It's a chess game. It's not backgammon, or it's not, you know, something that would be concluded much more quickly.
Of course, before the French Revolution, the French thought it would take a really long time, and they lost their heads. So at some point, the tide turns. And the question is, for whether it's Korea or Iran, what point do people really push for freedom?
I don't think that the analogy of the French Revolution is a good one with a counter-revolutionary, with any potential counter-revolutionary movement in Iran. The revolution is ensconced pretty well at this point. The revolutionary principles are ensconced. To move away from that, to hope for another revolution, is the same as hoping that democracy would break out all over the Middle East.
What's the unemployment rate among 30-year-old and below in Iran?
Urban, very high.
So you say it works, but in the context of what we think works, it doesn't.
No, that's true. What works in the Middle East works on different principles than what works, say, in California. Yeah, true.
Yeah, good point. You're listening to AHA Presents About Education on the Santa Barbara News Press radio station, and we'll be right back.
Here's a question. Do you enjoy experiencing the best of Santa Barbara? Tasty restaurants, scenic hiking, local banking experts. That's right, local banking experts. Montecito Bank and Trust was voted best bank again by the Santa Barbara Independent, Santa Barbara News Press, and San Ynez Valley News Readers. Plus, they have over 40 years of experience, 10 branches from Solvang to Westlake, a convenient on-the-go mobile banking app, and a savvy team of local decision makers. Visit Montecito.bank today. Montecito Bank and Trust, member FDIC.
Founded by a UCSB grad, Deckers Brands has grown into a global driver of lifestyle footwear. From humble beginnings in 1973, Santa Barbara has been a key element of the business, defining the company's culture, providing home base for many employees, and inspiring product innovation each year. For a first-hand experience, stop by the Deckers Brands headquarters in Goleta, 250 Coromar Drive, from 10 to 7, Monday through Saturday, 11 to 5 Sunday, and shop their new brand showcase retail test lab. Guaranteed, you'll see a new side to Deckers' portfolio, from footwear to handbags to home furnishings.
Celebrating 50 years of serving loyal regular guests and first-time visitors, the Pierre Lafond Market and Deli invites you to enjoy their huge selection of fresh-baked sweets, cookies, carrot cake, muffins, and the famous farm cake, granola, Oreo popcorn, wine cake, homemade soups, and the popular fresh juice bar. Or get a coffee drink or fresh-squeezed juice and peruse the famous wall of greeting cards at the Pierre Lafond Market and Deli. Open 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. daily in the Plaza del Sol, Montecito Village.
Habitat for Humanity of Southern Santa Barbara County is building strength, stability, and self-reliance through shelter. Habitat has completed construction on 19 new homes for affordable homeownership. We'll build 3 new affordable homes this spring and has repaired over 35 homes through the A Brush with Kindness program. To learn more about how you can support Habitat by volunteering, donating, or shopping at the Habitat Restore, visit sbhabitat.org or call 692-2226.
Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA, Improving Attitude, Creating Social Harmony, Bridging the Achievement Gap for Teens. I'm Neil Kreisel, and we're here with Dr. Manu Eskadari, who is the director of the Middle East Studies Program at Santa Barbara City College. And he has the same accent I do. It's slightly a New York accent. So I don't think you're a native of California. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Vienna, in Austria. I was born there, and spent 19 years of my life there, and then summers and vacations in Iran. And then in between those years, I spent 6 years in Iran with my father.
And your early education was in a liberal arts type of program?
Yeah, I went to a French private school, and throughout my high school education was in a French private school.
And were you interested in political science when you were in college, or was it after?
No, always. It's a family tradition to be in politics.
Meaning that your father and mm-hmm. or mother were actually political scientists?
Not my mother, no. But my Iranian side of the family has always been involved in politics.
And you found your way to one of the nicest spots in the free world, Santa Barbara. How did that happen?
Quite by accident, actually. My trajectory was to be an international diplomat as I was studying and preparing myself in Vienna, and then the revolution happened, which would not have affected my diplomatic track, but it did foreclose some doors. And as my wife and I were living in Vienna, we were looking at what to do and where to go for an additional degree that I wanted to have on my resume, and my professor suggested an American MA might not be a bad thing if you're going to be an international diplomat. I applied for a Fulbright grant and received it and came here as a Fulbright scholar in 1980. And once we got here, my wife said, I'm not moving.
Very smart. You had the Fulbright scholarship, but she knew to stay here. The last person I know that had a Fulbright scholarship moved to Arkansas. That was President Clinton. And that shows you where, you know, how much common sense he had.
Well, he was a Rhodes Scholar. Rhodes Scholarship is to Oxford University from all over the world.
Right.
Fulbright is to have this exchange. You come to America, but then you go back to the country of origin. And my wife said, I'm not going back to Austria. In those days, Austria was, I'm trying to put it mildly, they were not very friendly to foreigners. And my wife at that time had a very hard time in Vienna. There is still always a subset of that in Austria. Obviously, it has some of that nasty history still. They've much improved. But when we came here, this was paradise from gray buildings and, you know, gray people. Suddenly to be in sunny California, we didn't want to go back.
Did you see or read The Woman in Gold?
I'm quite familiar with that story, yes.
Yeah, and I crossed Austria off my list of places to go.
No, please don't. It's a completely changed place.
Since the 90s?
Yes. I was just there last year. Again, it's a completely... No, give it another look.
So how did you end up at Santa Barbara City College?
Well, I got my PhD at UCSB and started teaching there in 1985 as a lecturer, as an adjunct lecturer. And I was also working at UCSB. But I wanted to have an academic position. And given that I got my degree at UCSB, they would not hire me full-time as an academic there. And given that my wife wanted to stay in town for good reasons, the options were very limited. It would have been in this area, and I was lucky enough that a position came open at City College, and I applied for it was a successful candidate.
And you've been incredibly successful there. As I mentioned to you before the show, I taught there for 12 years, and while we were we never crossed each other's paths, people would talk about you incessantly about what a wonderful professor you are, which is one of the things about City College versus so many other institutions, that the mandate for City College is not to write and publish, but to teach and to motivate people. And so Santa Barbara City College is very lucky to have you.
Well, thank you.
So does getting young people passionate about the subject get you up in the morning? And is that going to help the world?
Yes, it does. You know, I've been in this gig at City College since 1992, and it does actually get me up in the morning, and it gives me the energy. There's also dread, obviously, involved in anything that one does. It gives me the energy to go and to see the possibility in young students. When you see that they get it, when you say something and it suddenly turns on a switch and it turns on a light, you see that in their eyes, and then you see it in their commitment. That's why I keep doing this. Yeah.
And what courses do you teach in political science?
I teach political theory, political philosophy. I teach comparative politics. I teach Middle East government and politics. That's been in abeyance right now, but I'm reviving it. I teach American government. I teach a course in political violence. And I have to explain to people that I'm not teaching them to be violent. Mm-hmm. We're talking about violence, political violence in all forms, from revolution to terrorism and war. And that's been a very nice course in the honors program. So these are the courses.
Yeah, so I understand why your wife wanted to move here. This way she doesn't have to see you. How many courses do you
teach? She's listening to this program right now.
She's probably laughing.
Don't put thoughts in her head.
So, you teach a full load then, as they say.
I teach a full load, yeah.
And so besides being director of the Middle East Studies Program, you're director of the Sacramento Program. What is that?
The Sacramento Internship Program. As part of our mandate to teach American government in California, you also have to teach California politics. And I thought, what better way to teach California politics than to take students on a graded internship, 1 week internship to Sacramento. So they are residents there for a week, and our hosts are now our assembly member and our senator in Sacramento. And then we also meet with, we've been hoping to meet with the governor, have not succeeded yet, but with his chief staff, senior staff. We met with the attorney general, we meet with the president pro tem, Kevin DeLeon. We meet with other principals in Sacramento who are basically involved in the policymaking process, and students see how difficult it is to go from idea to policy.
Although under the governor, this is the first time since I've been here, which is 19 years, that the government seems to be working. When I moved here, it was more dysfunctional than what we're seeing in Washington today.
No, California really, I mean, people sell California short because, you know, there's a lot of loose talk, but people should look at the numbers. It's really a miracle.
So you mentioned going to Sacramento. So if I want to go on a trip, you would recommend Austria over Sacramento? Is there
actually, you know, Sacramento, the city of Sacramento, I don't recommend it in the summer. It's 120 degrees there. But it's one of the least appreciated capitals. And certainly for Californians, many Californians have no appreciation for Sacramento. I do recommend it. Obviously, every big city has areas that are not as appealing and has aspects that are not as appealing. But I have a soft spot in my heart for Sacramento for, I don't know why actually, but it's grown on me, and I consider it to be the place I come back to every spring. And now, of course, I'm also reviving the Washington, D.C. program.
Well, we'll talk about your problem with Sacramento during the break. we'll help you out with that. You're listening to AHA Presents About Education on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back.
Thank you.
Here's a question. Do you enjoy experiencing the best of Santa Barbara? Tasty restaurants, scenic hiking, local banking experts. That's right, local banking experts. Montecito Bank and Trust was voted best bank again by the Santa Barbara Independent, Santa Barbara News Press, and Santa Ynez Valley News Readers. Plus, they have over 40 years of experience, 10 branches from Solvang to Westlake, a convenient on-the-go mobile banking app, and a savvy team of local decision makers. Visit Montecito.bank today. Montecito Bank and Trust, member FDIC.
For more than 20 years now, the unique landscape and people of the Santa Barbara community have helped grow Deckers Brands into the lifestyle footwear leaders they are today. Newly opened at their headquarters in Goleta, the Deckers Brand Showcase allows you to explore and shop the UGG, Teva, Sanuk, Hoka, and Ahnu brands while you're likely to discover something new or potentially receive an in-store special offer. At 250 Coromar Drive in Goleta, the showcase is open to the public 10 a.m. to 7 Monday through Saturday and 11 to 5 on Sunday.
You're invited to dine indoors or on the secluded garden patio, the sunny patio, or the covered creekside patio with fireplace at Pierre Lafon's Montecito Wine Bistro, where you'll enjoy the popular pizzas and many other dishes from the wood-burning oven, daily specials from Chef Victor, and selections from the elevated wine menu featuring Lafon and Santa Barbara Winery wines. Open daily at 11 for lunch, wine, cocktails, dinner, incredible desserts, and a daily happy hour from 3 to 6 with very unique appetizers, in the Plaza del Sol, Montecito Village.
Habitat for Humanity of Southern Santa Barbara County is building strength, stability, and self-reliance through shelter. Habitat has completed construction on 19 new homes for affordable homeownership. We'll build 3 new affordable homes this spring and has repaired over 35 homes through the A Brush with Kindness program. To learn more about how you can support Habitat by volunteering, donating, or shopping at the Habitat Restore, visit sbhabitat.org or call 692-2226.
Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA, helping teens achieve goals, surmount challenges, stop bullying, and communicate and listen effectively. I'm Neil Kreisel, and we're here today with Dr. Manu Escadari, who is the director of the Washington, D.C. SBCC program. What is that?
Many years ago, in 1997, with a colleague of mine, I'm created this program, the SBDC program, and we took students there for an entire semester, internships during the day and then classes in the evening, and then also she was a historian, I was the political scientist, so we got to see both historical sites, Revolutionary and Civil War, as well as Washington itself, and then on the political side, Congress, the House, the Senate, Supreme Court, etc., etc. The program continued into 2000, and then one of my colleagues in political science, David Lawyer, unfortunately passed away. And so the program then kind of went into hibernation. But with the Sacramento program, this one-week internship program that we have in spring, every spring, I thought it might be time to do a two-week program in Washington, D.C., over spring break and then a week after. 2 weeks is manageable at this point. It's not an entire semester. People would get credit the way they do for the Sacramento program with an additional unit. And it would be part of the mandate to educate people on how the policy process works at the national level. And that's very important because, again, as with Sacramento and Californians, Americans in D.C., most Americans have no idea what D.C. looks like, and never mind how it functions. And it's a surprise to them when they actually get to Washington, D.C., that this is their capital.
Well, the best story that's emblematic of that comment is that woman during the campaign that said, I want to make sure that the government keeps its hands off Medicare. people not only don't know what Washington looks like, they don't know what it does. They just don't like it. Yeah. Phi Theta Kappa Honor Society. Is that like Phi Beta Kappa?
It's the sister organization of Phi Beta Kappa. We are the junior organization to Phi Beta Kappa, but it does the same thing. This is the premier honor society for two-year colleges, and you can only join Phi Theta Kappa if you're at a two-year college. Joining Phi Theta Kappa does not mean that you then at a four-year college will be Phi Beta Kappa. These organizations are separate, but it's the same idea. international and national recognition at the highest level for academic achievement and excellence.
And you run the program?
I brought it. I was asked by the former executive director who came and visited me here in 96 whether I would be amenable to starting a chapter here. And in 97, we chartered our chapter. And I'm now the senior advisor.
Last week, we had Joe White on, who is, as you know, a philosophy professor, was a philosophy professor for many years, and I believe a friend of yours.
Yes, a very dear friend.
And listening to you today, I detect a little bit of philosophy in some of the logic that you've been using to make your points. Do you have a favorite philosopher?
Yes, as a matter of fact, the quote that you had on this sheet is from Plato, and I would hands down say Plato definitely is my first love, and I'm still my students. It's almost a byline now that in the political theory class it's going to be wall to wall Plato.
Is this a recent quote of his, or?
Yes, it is a recent quote. He was just interviewed.
Interesting that you had one, because Joe had about 10.
He likes to brag. It's enough for me to say Plato. Everything else kind of follows.
Do you think that, you know, we talked about the whole issue about Iran. You know, we didn't mention the Iran-Iraq war. Is there lessons in Iraq War One, Iraq War Two that the current administration should keep in mind?
Yes, yes. The first war was encouraged, and now we know this from documents that have been published, was encouraged by a lot of powers, including the United States, against the Iranian regime. For short-sighted reasons, the Iranians had taken Americans hostage. It was an affront to American foreign policy. Some elements of the American establishment were worried about what that would mean, a revolution in Iran. And so, as in politics, nature abhors a vacuum, the idea was gestated and then had its natural course that if there is a power vacuum in Iran, the revolution did create kind of a temporary setback for the strength of the institutions in Iran, that a neighboring country might move in. And there has always been this clash between the two countries when the Shah was in power, between Saddam Hussein, who was not considered by the Shah as anything relevant, just a junior fellow next door with a puny army. But when the revolution happened, the Iraqi army managed to have enough materiel supported by Western powers and by America to be able to drag Iran into an eight-year drag-out war, basically World War I style. Chemical attacks, trench warfare. It was horrible. It was horrible. Casualties were above a million. The destruction was about $500 billion on both sides. It was just devastating, and the entire swaths of Iran and Iraq were devastated by the war. Horrific in nature. It ended in a stalemate. The Iranians, to the surprise of everybody, including themselves, managed to hold off Saddam Hussein. It became the national and the nationalistic impetus for Iranians to this day to rally around Ahmadinejad, the previous president that everybody is unfortunately aware of, was a veteran of that war. So having been a veteran of that war gives you extra kudos in the Iranian establishment to this day. It was a devastating war for both countries. It weakened Saddam Hussein to the point that after that, Iraq, even though it managed, Saddam Hussein managed to keep Iraq together, Iraq was on a decline. Now, in the second war, in the 2003 war, that was an unmitigated disaster. Everybody knows that. People are loath admitting this here in parts of the political establishment, but the 2003 invasion of Iraq and the destruction of that regime, as loathsome as it was, has created all of this mosaic of breakdown that we now see in the Middle East.
Iran is Shiite and Iraq is
majority Shiite.
But Saddam Hussein was Sunni.
Saddam Hussein was Sunni and he was a minority Sunni ruling with an iron fist over all of Iraq.
So the way you describe the war between the two countries is the way I remember it being described back then, without ever using the word Sunni or Shiite. Mm. How much of that war was driven by religion or nothing?
Saddam Hussein was a secularist. He was a tribalist. His town, his people, but he was a Sunni. He had subjugated the Shiites of southern Iraq, gassed them, fought against them. So in that sense, there was a Sunni dimension to this. But the last thing Saddam Hussein would be identified with, if you were to ask him point blank, yes, I'm a Sunni, and this is a Sunni thing. It was mostly a Tigriti thing for him, and to keep his tribe and his power. But yes, there was this. There's always been the Shia-Sunni divide in the Middle East.
But it's interesting. The change has been that now we talk not so much about landmass, but we talk about religious war.
Yeah.
Things have gotten
Very tribal.
Very tribal now, yeah, which is interesting.
Yeah. But it's gotten tribal here too.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Unfortunately for us, and being worried about the future of the world, tribalism is on the rise again.
Yeah, the atomization of society is a real issue now.
Fortunately, the Europeans seem to have kind of woken themselves out of that nightmare and are moving away from it and are resuscitating the European Union and the philosophy behind it, remembering what that was about. But tribalism seems to have taken hold everywhere.
It's interesting. The Washington Post reported today that Trump apparently fears meeting Merkel, or is unhappy about meeting Merkel more so than he is about meeting Putin, which just goes to show.
He has a problem with strong women.
Exactly. You're listening to AHA Presents About Education on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back with our final segment.
Here's a question. Do you enjoy experiencing the best of Santa Barbara? Tasty restaurants, scenic hiking, local banking experts. That's right, local banking experts. Montecito Bank and Trust was voted best bank again by the Santa Barbara Independent, Santa Barbara News Press, and San Ynez Valley News Readers. Plus, they have over 40 years of experience, 10 branches from Solvang to Westlake, a convenient on-the-go mobile banking app, and a savvy team of local decision makers. Visit Montecito.bank today. Montecito Bank and Trust, member FDIC.
Available only at the company's headquarters in Goleta, the new Deckers brand showcase features the latest footwear from UGG, Teva, Sanuk, Hoka, and Ah New brands. You're invited to stop by to experience firsthand what makes Deckers brand so unique. Discover new product and try on a range of offerings from your favorite Deckers brand at their retail stores. Now open to the public 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. Monday through Saturday and from 11 to 5 on Sunday at 250 Coramar Drive in Goleta.
In 1962, Pierre Lafond founded the first post-prohibition commercial winery in Santa Barbara County. In 1972, he planted his first vineyard in the San Ynez Valley west of Buellton and later hired legendary winemaker Bruce McGuire to continue to build on the stellar reputation that Santa Barbara Winery has achieved for more than 50 years. Today, you're invited to experience the award-winning wines at Santa Barbara Winery at the corner of Yananali and Anacapa and the Lafond Winery at 6855 Santa Rosa Road in Buellton.
Habitat for Humanity of Southern Santa Barbara County is building strength, stability, and self-reliance through shelter. Habitat has completed construction on 19 new homes for affordable homeownership. We'll build 3 new affordable homes this spring and has repaired over 35 homes through the A Brush with Kindness program. To learn more about how you can support Habitat by volunteering, donating, or shopping at the Habitat Restore, visit sbhabitat.org or call 692-2226.
Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA helps teens manage their emotions, support their peers, and serve their community. We're here with Dr. Manu Eskedari, who is the professor of He is a professor at Santa Barbara City College in the Department of Political Science and Economics and director of the Middle East Studies Program. This line I just said, AHA helps teens manage their emotions, support their peers, and serve their communities. I guess we could substitute AHA with we'd like to see some of the political leaders of the world do the same thing.
Yes.
It's not just teens that are dysfunctional.
Yes.
So tell us about some of your future projects. You have some books that you're working on?
I just, in 2014, I published a translated and then elaborated on a manuscript that dealt with the early 19th century rulers of Iran, my ancestor. And I'm publishing a follow-up volume on that. And you asked me over the break about this project of a film. I would love to see films being made about the Muslim American and the Middle Eastern experience, but with humor. A lot of people are afraid to even tackle the question. And I think humor, there are great amounts of comedians. Masr Jobrani, for instance, who is an Iranian American comedian, is fantastic. Mm-hmm. People like that, to be able to bring humor into the situation and diffuse some of the fears and apprehensions that people have, I think, is a very important. I do that in my classes, as my students would attest to. That disarms people from, you know, the armor that they have on, and they cannot talk about things. So I think if that could be done, because America is in love with the visual medium, a film that would intelligently bring out some of the complexities and do it in a humorous way, not preachy way, but humorous way, I think it would be a great vehicle.
And if someone wanted to read your books, how would they go about getting a copy?
Seriously, you want me to advertise on this?
I do. Well, not advertise. You're not paying. I'd like you to promote.
All right. I'm not used to this, but Mage Publishers in Washington, D.C., MAGE Publishers in Washington, D.C., and the book is called Life at the Court of the Early Qajars.
And the Justice Project Initiative, what's that?
Noah Benche and a group of people, Sarah McCune, have created this Justice Project, and Noah asked me to be one of the advisors on the board of the Justice Project. There is a website that I would recommend people to go to, and it has to do with with the question of social justice. I think it's called justiceproject.org, mm-hmm. and it has to do with social justice issues, education, bringing books to disadvantaged communities, etc. A lot of projects that Noah himself is supervising, and many more that hopefully one. I had the idea of creating a House of Peace, which would bring people from the Middle East here, talking about the Palestinian and Israeli conflict.
It's going to be easy for them to come into the country now.
Easy. Those kinds of projects. That's a very worthwhile thing to look at.
And you have a not-for-profit that you're working with?
Yes. For the last 20 years, I created an organization called the International Qajar Studies Association. And we've had conferences around the world on 19th century Persia, precisely because of the biased image about the politics of 19th century Persia that I felt I would like to do something to rectify to a great degree, and we've been very successful. I have now stepped down as president of that after all these years, but the effort continues.
And what's the website?
It's qajarstudies.org.
Dr. Eskandari, thank you so much. The kids at City College are lucky to have you as a professor. I would like you to be a professor in Washington for some of the people there, but I don't think that's going to happen. Thanks for being here today.
And thank you very much.
And we'll see you all back here next week for another edition of AHA Presents About Education.